Struggling with mental health shouldn't be the norm. At Mindful Therapy Group, we specialize in connecting you with compassionate therapists to find the perfect fit for you. Mindful Therapy Group accepts most health insurances. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com to start your mental health journey today.
For the past three seasons of Gone South, we've covered one story per season. Now, Gone South is back for a fourth season. But this time, we're doing things a little differently. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
The holidays are all about sharing with family. Meals, couches, stories, grandma's secret pecan pie recipe. And now, you can also share a cart with Instacart's family carts. Everyone can add what they want to one group cart from wherever they are. So you don't have to go from room to room to find out who wants cranberry sauce, or who should get mini marshmallows for the yams, or collecting votes for sugar cookies versus shortbread. Just share a cart and then share the meals and the moments. Download the Instacart app and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Plus, enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
It is raining outside, and there's some traffic issues heading on to the Spoway from Kenner, heading out to Laplace. Different accidents, so be aware of that. Highs of 68 today, about a 70% chance for showers today and tomorrow. Then a front comes through. Lows in the 50s to 60s for the next couple of days. Highs in the lower 70s, that'll be a nice respite. Kind of fall-ish, not quite fall-like. And then we're back to the 80s by the weekend, and no real cold Arctic blast, jacket weather, anything like that coming. But be careful today, and remember, you got to have, obviously, I hope you got the lights on now because it's still dark, but if your windshield wipers are on, by state law, you're supposed to have your headlights on as well. David Schultz joins us now, professor of political science at Hamline University. Good morning, David. How are you?
I am doing well, and I hope you're well, too.
I am. You know, it's funny how politics makes for strange bedfellows, because if you had given me a crystal ball back in the day of the debates in 2016, I guess it was, with Donald Trump and little Marco Rubio and hand size and all of this foolishness that was going on, to think that, okay, let's fast forward, 2024, Donald Trump's going to name Marco Rubio to be Secretary of State. I don't think I'd have seen that coming. You?
I didn't either. When I saw the headline yesterday, I wiped my glasses off and reread it and said, am I reading this correctly or something like that? I mean, I did not see that coming whatsoever. I mean, I'm looking at some of his other appointments. Yeah, I could see Elise Stefanik for a couple of things.
Sure.
But Marco Rubio, completely out of the ballpark in terms of something that I would have seen.
Talk about Kristi Noem as Director of Homeland Security. I can see that, because these are all Trump loyalists, and we all know that the president-elect favors, I think it's fair to say, loyalty above all else. Accurate?
I think it's very accurate that which also explains why Nikki Haley, at least for now, I think, isn't going to be in his administration, because she made the big mistake of challenging him during the primary. But I could still see a scenario where he picks her for something. But I think you're right. Basically, loyalty over all us.
Let's talk about the picks that the president-elect has made so far, or at least the things he's indicating. And I guess first, David, let's take a step back and talk about a president, any president, picking their cabinet, and who has say over that, or given the party in control and all that stuff.
Well, first off, remember that the people who are in the cabinet do have to be confirmed by the Senate. I mean, the Constitution requires senior level people to be appointed. There's a process for that. But generally, before they get to the formality issue here, it's usually presidents are going to pick people who appease particular constituencies or interest groups, you know. And so if, for example, you know, you're indebted to, I don't know, Silicon Valley, or you're indebted to, I don't know, let's say if you're a Democrat, the educational establishment, you pick people, you know, who sort of both align with your ideology and at the same time align with the pressure from particular interest groups. Trump is sort of doing that, I think, right now, too, in terms of picking people who are loyal and seem to be aligning with where he seems to want to be on a variety of issues.
And this is not just with President-elect Trump. This is any president. During the whole campaign process, sometimes cabinet positions are kind of it's understood that if you give me your support, you'll get this?
Exactly. This is the, you know, what's that phrase they use? Quid pro quo.
Yeah.
You do this for me, I'll do that for you. This is kind of the quid pro quo. So even though you technically can't, like, bribe somebody or pay somebody or give them something of value, you know, to endorse your campaign, you can sort of implicitly do that and say, listen, Bobby Kennedy Jr., endorse me, and there might very well be a position in my cabinet for you. Or they don't even have to go that far. It's actually saying that. It's just kind of what understood.
Who is Trump's former Secretary of State? That surprised me. Mike Pompeo?
It was Pompeo was, I think, the last one. The first one, God, what was his name now? He was the person. Oh, my God. He was the, now I'm blanking on it. Wasn't he the oil person?
Rex Tillerson.
Yeah. I was going to say, because he lasted, what, about not even a year or something like that, if I remember correctly. And Pompeo was eventually the Secretary of State. It was his chiefs of staff that he went through a pile of those.
But Pompeo did he do anything that Trump could have portrayed as disloyal or interpreted as disloyal?
He has been, let's say, not 100% loyal. And I think Trump generally is a, you know, 100% or nothing person here. And I think Pompeo in the last few weeks made a few critical comments about Trump. I just can't remember what they were off the top of my head. But certainly he wants a circle of people even more loyal than he had the first time.
Let's talk about cabinet positions and influence and how, to me, I see some people getting spun up about this or about that, but you don't have to be a cabinet official to have an influence on Donald Trump or any president. All you have to do is have his or her ear, right?
That's absolutely correct there, that many presidents throughout time have had, you know, the informal advisors who they turn to, who are not part of the cabinet. Maybe they're just considered what, presidential advisors, and have lots of influence. I mean, we could go so far as to say that for many presidents, certainly not all of them, many presidents, their most important unofficial advisor has been their wife. I mean, we know going back over time, you know, whether it's the Roosevelts or, you know, Obama, so forth like that. I'm just trying to think of a variety of places here.
Reagan.
I was going to say Nancy Reagan. I was just blanking. Nancy Reagan. They've had important observations or comments. I mean, the second George Bush, and the first George Bush, both their wives seem to have had some influence. And it's not to be surprised. You know, not a surprise there that for most of us, you know, who are married, we oftentimes discuss, you know, certain things and bounce them off of our partners. And we've developed those relationships. We have friends that we talk to. So in our private life, we have all types of informal connections. And what would surprise us, or why should we be surprised, that the president wouldn't have a bunch of informal connections or people that person trusts?
But that being said, as far as we know, Melania Trump has not really involved herself in politics, or has she? What do we know?
It does not look like it at this point that she, you know, unless I missed something during the campaign, I don't think she was out campaigning for him at all. Now, somebody wants to call in or text in and say, yeah, she was here such and such. But I don't recall her being out there in the same way that, for example, Harris's husband was out there campaigning, or even J.D. Vance's wife, I think, was out there a little bit like stumping for her husband. And in the past, we oftentimes do see the president's, president's wives are out there campaigning. But I think she has been singularly quiet. Again, if somebody remembers something out there, but I don't remember anything. Do you?
No, but that being said, I guess, you know, you never know what goes on in a residence between a couple. Who knows what's doing what? I was just curious about that. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back. Yeah. David Schultz, our guest, professor of political science at Hamline University, talking about what President-elect Trump's cabinet could look like. 621 Traffic Now, WWL. 626 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, also a professor of law. David, you know, I was wondering, what happened to Ivanka and who's her husband?
Oh, Jared Kushner?
Jared Kushner, where have they been? I have not really seen them on a campaign. Have you?
I did not either, and I think I saw a piece the other day that indicated that Jared Kushner has said he's not interested in any position in the Trump administration whatsoever. And I think he's just going to go off and him and his wife go off and make a bunch of money.
Because they were influential in the first Trump presidency, were they not?
Oh, they were tremendously. Jared was the one who designed the Trump's Middle East plan for peace plan that went absolutely nowhere. But yeah, they were tremendously involved. I would swear that at least once a week in the news, we heard something about them.
So for people that are concerned, and I'm watching the TVs in here, one of them is talking about liberal, what did it say just now on Fox News, something about meltdowns or something along those lines. You are a professor of law as well. For people that are just apoplectic about the results of the election, explain to them, if you will, please, how, you know, that there are constitutional guardrails in effect, despite what was said during the campaign about this or about that or the other thing, that we do have a constitution in this country and there are institutions, even though Trump won popular vote and he won electoral landslide, that there are other people in the country and that it doesn't have to be all one way for those people that are worried about that, is what I'm trying to say.
Sure. So remember, first off, when he got elected, you know, 8 years ago in 2016, he had a trifecta. He had control of the House and the Senate, and he certainly didn't get everything he wanted back then. And that's important to understand because we do have these basic things called checks and balances, separation of powers, federalism, a whole bunch of things. The Constitution requires that Congress pass bills, have to be signed by the president into law, that there's limits on what presidents can do in terms of executive orders. And I just mention all of that because, right, during the hysteria of the campaign, you know, he probably engaged in a lot of exaggerations. And it wouldn't be the first candidate to do that. And people were all kinds of fears at the end of the day that, yes, we do have a constitution, that, yes, the Senate is going to be required to confirm his nominations to the courts, to the cabinet, and so forth like that. But, yes, we saw from his first term that when he tried to change a bunch of executive orders, the court struck it down. The Constitution, as far as I know, still exists.
So real quick, I wonder about the political calculus as far as Donald Trump goes, because he always was this giant, larger-than-life figure, right? Well, he won, so now, is he still the king maker, or is it a wide open field? And do people really have to, like the Nikki Haley's of the world, do they pause for a minute before challenging him and positioning? Because let's face it, the election has already begun for 2028, has it not?
It has, and he's a lame duck already. Remember, he's not even in office yet. He's going to go to a second term. The Constitution prevents him from running for a third term. So he faces the problem of being a lame duck right off the bat. And that means on one level, he's got a lot of power because he's starting off his new term. But on the other level, it means they don't have to fear retribution because he's going to be out of office in 4 years.
That's what I was wondering. And he's also going to be 78, 82 years old, I guess, by then. Thank you, David. I appreciate the time. I'm just trying to give everybody a voice in this nation because everybody does have a voice. It's 6:30. We'll talk about manufacturing in the United States when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. Get back, Loretta. 6:47, 13 till 7. Tim Zimmer bringing us back. Tim's under the weather today. Not feeling well at all. Coming back from vacation. I don't know what he did, but he got himself sick. So rain today and then rain tomorrow. I've not seen anything from the city about neutral ground parking, although they usually do that after it's too late. 70% chance for showers today and tomorrow. Then it clears out, cools off a little bit. Highs only in the 70s. After Thursday, Willie Shih joins us now, professor of management practice at Harvard Business School. Talk about manufacturing returning to the United States. How you doing, Professor?
Oh, good. How are you today, Tommy?
I'm okay, sir. Somebody texted in. I asked them about buying American. They said, I'm a mechanic. I still try to buy as many tools made in USA as I can. Channel Lock, Matthew Chisels, of course, Snap-on, but they're so high-priced. First of all, how easy is it to determine what is an American product these days?
Well, Tommy, it is getting more difficult because what you see is the import of a lot of partially finished or, you know, kind of intermediate goods things. There's a lot of stuff coming out of Mexico, for example. And, you know, I do the same thing. I try to buy American-made tools, but they are more expensive because, you know, costs are higher in the U.S. So it's kind of a mixed bag. It's tough these days, though.
When it comes to a consumer determining what's completely made in America, is there a way to do that, Professor?
Well, usually what you do is you look at the label on the box, and that will tell you there are sort of kind of import content rules. In order to be made in the U.S., you have to have a certain amount of its value added in the U.S. But, you know, in reality, a lot of parts and subcomponents, like you can have a car that is assembled in the U.S., but a lot of the parts are going to come from Mexico or China or Japan or all over the world, as a matter of fact. It might still be a made-in-the-U.S. car, but, you know, a lot of the subsystems have come from elsewhere.
So what can the new Trump administration do? Because I think we all would like it to be, well, not everybody, because of some of the social implications, but when it comes to manufacturing, you know, go back to the 40s or the 50s where you had the steel plants and churning out this and that and manufacturing that, and everything was bought in America, sold in America, God bless the USA, all that. But how likely is something like that to happen?
Well, I think it's tough. I think there are certain things that we will be able to make in the U.S. In fact, we continue to make in the U.S. Those tend to be high value-added products that have, you know, frankly, a little lower labor content, or the labor content is not a big part of the final cost. I always cite jet aircraft engines as a great example. Those are very high-value manufactured product. They're made in the U.S., The U.S. is a world leader in that area. And, you know, while there is substantial labor cost, it is not a dominant part of the product. Now, you go to the $29.95 blender that you find at your local Walmart, okay, and there's a lot of labor cost in that. Those aren't going to be made in the U.S. anytime in the foreseeable future, in my book.
And for people that want to buy American, I don't know if there is an option or not, but we were having this discussion last week. I don't know if it was with you, Professor. It's been a long couple of weeks, but about you can do it, but the labor, if you want to buy a product that is, say, labor intensive and it was made in the United States, you can do it now. But let's say clothing, for example. You're not going to get the price that you are on a jacket made in Vietnam or the Pacific Rim, correct?
That's right. You can buy, let's talk about shoes, for example. You can buy American-made athletic shoes. New Balance has a factory up here in Massachusetts that I visited a couple of years ago. But those shoes are more expensive, and they are usually made kind of custom for professional athletes because they're, you know, the labor cost is high, but, you know, people are willing to pay. If you want a low-cost jacket, you know, it's going to be hard to beat bringing it in from Bangladesh or Vietnam or Indonesia or somewhere like that, just because labor costs are such a substantial part of the overall cost of the product. It's just hard to beat when the U.S. costs 20, 30 times as much as doing something in the Far East.
Where do robotics fit in all of this? I was watching 60 Minutes the other night. A promo came on, and they were carving a statue with a robot. And I'm just wondering, as we talk about labor costs and advances, would robotics help in the United States manufacturing effort or not? But if it does, it's not going to lead to more manufacturing jobs, right, because it's robots that are doing it? Tell me about
that.
Well,
that's right. That's right. I mean, robots, if you go in most factories, what people will do is they'll use robots to replace labor on simple tasks. Okay, so for example, stacking boxes on a pallet. Mm-hmm. Most manufacturers are automating that with robots. And, you know, it's kind of back-breaking work in the first place, so you'd kind of like a robot to do that for you. Okay, but yes, it does replace those kind of simpler jobs, and it's all part of increasing productivity in manufacturing so you can be cost competitive with a higher cost labor force. Okay, so that's kind of the dilemma we face. You know, we need more and more productivity, but that means the jobs have to change.
So when it comes to clothing manufacturing, I'm just curious, they can't roboticize, and I just made that word up, Professor, please feel free to claim it as your very own. They can't roboticize that? They can't have robots manufacture clothing?
Well, clothing is a tough one because it's, and it's kind of common sense when you think about it, but it's soft. It's a soft material. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what happens is when you try to handle it, it moves around. And that's very hard for robots to do these days, you know, because what you want is you want kind of hard materials that don't shift and you can do things in a very repeatable way. Soft materials have always been very hard to automate. Now, there is some level of automation when you think about basic sewing machines, okay, or machines that, you know, cut a whole stack of fabric and so on. But there's still, you know, guiding the fabric into the machine and so on. That's something that's very hard to automate. It's people are working on it, and they've been working on it for years, but it is a tough one.
As you say, that made me think of the old joke, traveling more than a cheap suit. Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me,
Tom. Have a good
day.
All right, Professor Willie Shee, Professor of Management Practice at Harvard Business School, 6:55, 5 till 7, rainy Tuesday morning. Let's look at traffic on WWL.
Why get all your holiday decorations delivered through Instacart? Because maybe you only bought 2 wreaths, but you have 12 windows. Or maybe your toddler got very eager with the advent calendar. Or maybe the inflatable snowman didn't make it through the snowstorm. Or maybe the twinkle lights aren't twinkling. Whatever the reason, this season, Instacart's here for hosts and their whole holiday haul. Get decorations from the Home Depot, CVS, and more through Instacart and enjoy free delivery on your first 3 orders. Service fees and terms apply.
For the past 3 seasons of Gone South, we've covered one story per season. Now, Gone South is back for a 4th season. But this time, we're doing things a little differently. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Struggling with mental health shouldn't be the norm. At Mindful Therapy Group, we specialize in connecting you with compassionate therapists to find the perfect fit for you. Mindful Therapy Group accepts most health insurances. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com to start your mental health journey today.
Oh, the staff here, they do things to make me laugh like you wouldn't believe. 7:15 now on a rainy Tuesday morning, November 12th, joined by Representative Mike Baham, our friend, talk about the governor's tax reform plan. How you doing, Representative?
Doing fine, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Let's talk about the inventory tax portion of this. Again, I think we talked about it last week. I've spoken to a lot of people, and I get a little bit confused. But I was interested from the first time I first learned that there was an inventory tax, because I was wondering, well, why would you have to pay tax on inventory? Then I found out that Louisiana was one of the few places that you had to do it. I don't know about the historical context, but what kind of progress has been made on that as far as the committee hearings and so forth with the governor's plan to, I guess, eliminate it, Representative?
Well, it's not to eliminate it, but to give parishes a local option on whether to collect it or not. Now, those bills have left Ways and Means. They all passed. I believe we'll be taking them up today at noon. On the Florida legislature of the House of Representatives. And the inventory tax will become optional. Now, most parishes collect quite a bit of this revenue, and it helps offset the tax burden on the community, homeowners and such. So that's why, and it pays for police, it pays for education, pays for the operations of government. So it's used in multifaceted ways in a community.
So I guess what I'm wondering here, and again, keep in mind, I don't know a lot about this, but I'm just trying to figure out if a concern would be loss of revenue to local governments and it would be up to them, why would they do away with this? And if that's the case, then what are we really accomplishing with this?
Well, some parishes don't collect as much as others. They don't have a lot of industry there. They don't have a lot of big businesses there. So where the governor's view is on this is that if parishes choose to opt out of it, those parishes become much more attractive places for businesses to relocate. Now, ideally, those businesses will be coming from other states or will represent foreign investment, new foreign investment in the state, they'll see the advantages of going into a community or a parish that doesn't collect the inventory tax. So they're not going to, their overhead's not going to be so great. However, if you look along the industrial corridor of Louisiana, particularly on the river, Plaquemine up through East Baton Rouge, where you have a lot of refineries, those are where the inventory tax generates a great deal of revenue for our parishes, including St. Bernard. Those refineries really can't move.
No.
So a lot of those parishes are very unlikely to forgo the inventory tax, because you'll either have serious cuts to the parish government, the community, or they'll have to raise taxes on homeowners, which no one wants to do. I know in St. Bernard Parish, the inventory tax is about 17% of our total ad valorem collections across St. Bernard. So that would be a pretty big hit for us. It would hit our parish government, it hit our school system, and it would hit our sheriff's office.
So I guess I'm wondering if it just seems like a lot is being made about this when nothing's going to really happen. Like you're saying, a refinery is not going to get up and move. That's a big capital investment. I guess the governor could be thinking that maybe by having some parishes opt out, it would make them more attractive for the next, not refinery, although we haven't built a refinery in a long time, but for the next type of
production facility? Well, not necessarily a refinery. I mean, any kind of manufacturing plant.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Louisiana is one of the few states in the South that we don't have a single automotive plant. And if some of these parishes that have a lot of land and decent access to the interstate were to not or to forgo the inventory tax, and the governor has a plan that, in fact, it's in the bill that provides a financial incentive to parishes that are looking to opt out of the inventory tax, or paying them a three-year lump sum if they do it immediately, or slightly reduced by, I believe, one-third payment on 3 years' worth of inventory tax collections. They're to forgo that as a means of trying to get some new investment in those parishes. Now, a concern I raised in the Ways and Means Committee is this going to bring in new industry into our state, or is there going to be simply a reshuffling of industry that's already existing in Louisiana? Now, our revenue secretary and our secretary of economic development feels that this will be more of a gain to the state rather than just simply rearranging the chairs on the deck.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a break. We'll come back. I want to talk about buckets of money here, because I'm trying to keep an eye on that. Like you're talking about 17% ad valorem in St. Bernard Parish, and if St. Bernard were to opt out, and you're saying that's not likely, what would that
three? We're not opting out.
Not opting out.
Spoiler alert. All we're right. not opting out.
So what would happen then with parishes that decide to do that with a three-year lump sum for their local law enforcement? I'm trying to understand all this, Representative, but I know you'll help me when we get back. Mike Bayham on the House Ways and Means Committee, Louisiana State Representative, 721. More when we return. You have any questions about the inventory tax, 504-260-1870. I'll be glad to pass them along. Right now it's time for WWL Traffic. All right, 726 and a half. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Mike Bayham on Ways and Means Committee, Louisiana State Representative, about the governor's tax reform plan. Kind of drilling down on inventory tax this morning. So I'm talking about buckets of money, Mike. So you got St. Bernard's Parish bucket of money. You got the state's bucket of money. St. Bernard is not going to opt in on this, doing away with the inventory tax, because 17% of their ad valorem taxes comes from inventory taxes. Is that what you told me?
That's correct.
Okay. So, for parishes that do opt in, first of all, by St. Bernard not opting in, what does that have to do with
the
state's...
Opting out, actually.
Okay. What does that have to do with the state's bucket of money?
Well, this really is about economic development. So, if you look at a parish, and I'll give you a good example, the chairman of the House Commerce Committee, Daryl Desitel, represents primarily a Boyle's Parish. They don't collect much in inventory tax. They don't have a whole lot of industry there. where you've got where this hits. So he's of the belief, and by the way, when you do this, one, it's irreverent. Once you do it, you can't go back. So that's part of the deal of taking the money. But the decision would be made by the school board, the sheriff, and I believe the parish council or the police jury, and if they're not a home rule charter parish. So there's a process with all of this, but they may view this as something that they make this revenue up and then some on the back end by bringing in new industry into their community. So if you're a parish that's currently, like, the $15 million buyout for us incentive would not in any way equal to what we're would only equal to about 1 year's worth of collection. So we'd lose that stream forever. So St. Bernard and Orleans, I think Orleans would collect about $33 million or $30 million in inventory tax every year. So they'd be, those communities would have very little incentive to leave. But other parishes that are looking to bring in new businesses, they may see this as, hey, an opportunity to become competitive, and what little money they're currently collecting in inventory tax right now, that would be more made up for with later investment and development and new industries relocating to their parish.
So, but when it comes to, there are tax credits involved with the inventory tax that the companies pay, right, from the state?
Yeah, that's also one of the big issues we're dealing with right now, is that, you know, the credits offset the inventory tax, and a lot of industry is a little concerned about that. And we certainly want to be good partners with industries that have invested heavily in our state and ensure that they don't get that they don't get left on the hook, so to speak, by having to continue to pay the inventory tax, yet also losing the tax credit. So we're trying to be mindful of everyone's interests.
It's complicated. Thank you, Representative. Be safe going to Baton Rouge. And somebody texted in, please please put your lights on. If you got, state law says if you got the windshield wipers on, you got to have the lights on. Thank you, Representative. We'll talk to Jason Waggetts back when we come back. Go rain today, go rain tomorrow, then clears up and cools off a little bit. Highs in the 70s, lows in the 50s to 60s, but we got to get through today and tomorrow. The legislative special session continues about tax reform. Part of what they're looking at doing is eliminating, as I understand it, the motion picture tax credit program. Jason Wagensback joins us now, president of Film Louisiana, to talk about that. How you doing, Jason?
Good. How are you doing today, Tommy? Thanks for having me.
I'm okay, sir. Are they talking about eliminating this tax credit program completely or revising it, or what are you hearing?
Well, what you and all your audience needs to understand is that the governor has created a brand new tax reform package that includes all tax credits, exemptions, and rebates. And so therefore, there's over 200 of those at the state level. And we're just one of them that's part of the package that he's trying to restructure. Yes, currently they're looking to sunset them on June 30th of 2025. But the idea is for us to get into a fiscal session and really work out what the new LED, what they're calling toolbox, looks like of incentives in the spring session.
Tell me about these 200 tax credits that are available to industry. That's what you're saying, right? That they're looking at all of them?
They're looking at every one of them. So what they've done is they've gone out and taken a look at several other states in comparison to what Louisiana offers as a tax incentive. And they've come to a decision that a flat tax is the best thing for the state. But inclusion of that is to wipe away all, again, tax credits, redemptions, and exemptions, so that they can get to a certain point to level out the budget. The problem is that, and that we see, is that if you're going to take away an incentive that has so many businesses that are flourishing here, including the film industry, you're going to end up losing a lot of tax base that's already here if you're going to hurt those businesses. So that's the argument we're currently making at this time.
So is it all of these credits that are being looked at, or just some?
All of them. Historical, okay. Franchise.
Oil and gas, everybody?
Well, oil and gas is one of the ones that's not necessarily being looked at, but everything else is being looked at. Let's put it that way.
All right. Tell me about specifically the film industry and other states and how it works there and how it works here, and what, if you're going to compare and contrast, what we would find.
So the majority of the 40 states that now have a film program that have, most of them have copied our program, they've cookie-cuttered our program, the majority of them are a tax credit or a rebate. And so the way it works is that a project, i.e. the Haunted Mansion, let's say, the one that Disney just recently did and released last year, they would come into the state, they would apply for a credit, they would spend their money, up to $100 million of their production budget here. They would go through an audit process for almost 2 years, and then they would receive a credit against the liability of the taxes here in the state of Louisiana, or they can sell it back to the state for a fee, where the state actually recovers even more money back to their general fund.
And that's the way it works here, or other states, or both?
It's the way it works, I'd say, about 50% of the states that are out there. A lot of the other ones are just a straight rebate where they come in and they do what I just laid out, but then they're just handed a check at the end of their audit versus even taking it towards their liability or selling it back. So, yes, it is very similar to the majority of other states out there. Correct.
So with what states are we competing, and why would we want to do away with it when they don't, or do they want to do away with it as well?
No, the majority of other states are actually increasing the tax credits. Interesting, Texas is looking to double their program. You have North Carolina that lost their program almost 10 years ago, brought it back online 3 years later to realize that they lost a massive advantage in the workforce as well as the opportunities in marketing that had come to their state because of the film industry. We're seeing a massive increase across the country. I think the problem that we run into here is that, you know, our tax structure is completely different than anywhere else. And again, our leaders are looking at creating a tax change. And honestly, we agree, the industry agrees that there should be some sort of tax change that will attract more business to the state of Louisiana. We just don't believe that you should, you know, detriment all the other businesses that are currently here and flourishing for that reason. And so therefore, we think that if you can find a way to obviously alleviate the tax credits that are creating a lot more business opportunities here in the state, but go in and create a different tax burden, we could have a win-win situation where we're keeping jobs here, high-paying jobs here, and allowing for more business to come in.
Now, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We'll kind of drill down on that and see what that would look like and what it is that I believe you testified already. Did you not?
Yes, I did. On Thursday of last week, I did.
About what you would like to see them do and what would work best for the state of Louisiana, for the people involved in the film industry. And also want to talk about the timing of all of this, uncertainty and capital investment and more, and what kind of projects Louisiana are lined up for Louisiana, and at the time frame that people need to decide what's going to be in position, what's not, to decide whether or not to come here. Because I don't think, like, you decide to make a movie or pick locations in a week. I think a lot of that has to do with pre-planning. But we'll find out. We come back, 7:50, 10 till 8. Traffic now, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Jason Wagensback, president of Film Louisiana. The governor's special session underway. We talked to Mike Boeheim earlier about inventory taxes. We're talking with Jason Wagensback about film tax credit. What did you tell them when you testified, Jason, and make your case, and what would you like to see done ideally as it relates to your industry? I'm looking at this report that the NOLA.com quoted that about return on investment. I think it said the GDP grew by only 60 cents for every dollar spent on the film tax credit program for the 2022-2023 year. And the report says state revenue decreased by 90 cents for every dollar spent on the film tax credit program. Does that tell a whole story or not?
Well, you also have to understand that LED does an impact study every 2 years on the film industry. And every 2 years, for the last 6 years, they've reported that for every dollar that comes out of the state in tax credits towards the film industry, $6.32 goes back into the economy, creating a massive economic impact and a ripple effect. And what I testified to on Thursday is a very simple fact, and I think I've told it on your show before. And if you think about it this way, $180 million comes out of the state fisk goes into the film industry, which generates $1 billion, with a B, on average, sales from the film industry to the state of Louisiana. And $360 million of that goes directly to local Louisiana residents. So essentially, you're taking $180 million, you're giving it directly to Louisiana residents, and you're getting $600 million in sales on top of that. How is that not a massive impact to the state of Louisiana and a winning business model that this state created 20 years ago, that every other state, almost 40 states, have now copycatted? We are number five in the nation. Louisiana did something right. We have kids all over this state that are coming out of school looking to work in our industry, and we are doing what they're asking to do, which is reverse the brain drain. We're keeping people here. And here we are now trying to obviously figure out a new tax structure, but also figure out how we're going to keep this business alive in the state.
So somebody texting in, if they want to voice their opinion, what would you suggest they do in favor of these tax credits, keeping them?
Contact your legislator. Email them, call them, tell them how it impacts you, your family. The interesting part is that we have a swell of people around the state that are affected by this, not only by films coming into their backyard, but people that have come from all over the state to work in the industry. And I would go and contact your friends and family from all over the state to contact their legislators and let them know how they're impacted by this effect that's currently going on right now.
Let me talk real quick in the minute and a half we have left about the nature of the business itself and pre-planning, capital investment, all that stuff. Does this trigger some uncertainty that could affect projects in the future, and how important is it that they get this hammered out quickly?
Tommy, I think any business that creates uncertainty and unpredictability in any state or any community that they're working in is obviously going to create a detriment for that business. And so I speak on behalf of all of these tax credits that are looking to be on the chop block, that all of these businesses would be affected. So I see, obviously, the mere fact that we're trying to create a way to continue a path of building this high-paying $68,000 a year jobs and continue pumping in more economic impact and more investment, because we've invested over $350 million in infrastructure here over the last 10 years to bring that industry here, and we've seen it flourish. So obviously, I'm looking for whatever way I can to implore more of that impact and more of that investment in this state, and we have a real opportunity to keep it here in the state of Louisiana.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate your time and your insights. Jason Wagensback, president of Film Louisiana. When we come back, we'll talk to Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director, about them Saints.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Struggling with mental health shouldn't be the norm. At Mindful Therapy Group, we specialize in connecting you with compassionate therapists to find the perfect fit for you. Mindful Therapy Group accepts most health insurances. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com to start your mental health journey today.
Why get all your holiday decorations delivered through Instacart? Because maybe you only bought two wreaths, but you have 12 windows. Or maybe your toddler got very eager with the advent calendar. Or maybe the inflatable snowman didn't make it through the snowstorm. Or maybe the twinkle lights aren't twinkling. Whatever the reason, this season, Instacart's here for hosts and their whole holiday haul. Get decorations from the Home Depot, CVS, and more through Instacart and enjoy free delivery on your first three orders. Service fees and terms apply.
8:15, rainy Tuesday morning. It'll be rainy Tuesday, rainy Wednesday. Then it cools off a little bit. Sun comes back. Until then, be careful and slow down, because ain't nobody going anywhere quickly today. And remember, by state law, when you have the wiper, windshield wipers on, you have to have your headlights on. I'm getting a lot of texts about that, so I thought I'd pass it along. Steve Geller joins us now, WWL Sports Director. Talk about the Saints. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing good, Tommy. And for folks driving too, headlights, yes. Hazards, no, please. That, man, that just drives me insane.
All right, thanks for getting that out of the way as well, because I've been text on that too. So for, you know, you heard about Merry Christmas, right?
Yes.
All right, I came up with one that you can have. I'm going to give you this for free, and it's called the Saints Resurrection.
Oh, I like it, Tommy. Very good.
Yeah, thank you. Tell me what was the difference from what you hear, from what you see, being around a team. Why could such a difference be made in a week?
Yeah, it's pretty wild. Obviously, the matchup was still a tight one against the Atlanta Falcons squad. The biggest difference for the Saints team this past game is they found the way to win instead of coughing up the lead. It was a little dicey at the end, but like I said, when you find a way to win, that's all that matters. And we heard leading up to this game all the little differences that Coach Rizzi had implemented to make people uncomfortable. And he's like, when you're in uncomfortable situations, you got to make people uncomfortable to find that change. Everything from, we heard, moving the locker rooms around, the players in the locker room, the practice schedule. And he mentioned even going into this week to find that same kind of energy. He's going to do a little tweaks here and there. Obviously nothing as dramatic as moving guys in the locker room, but wanting to keep things fresh, keep the players on their toes. And I think a lot of it, unfortunately, under Dennis Allen was things got stale real quick in the losing skid. He didn't change anything. And that personality wasn't as boisterous as a Rizzi. And I feel like players kind of tuned out Allen's message. And obviously you can't have that when you're the head coach. Love seeing the energy, the passion, that fight back from this team. But like I said, Coach Rizzi mentioned the fact that's his biggest challenge going into this week, to maintain that kind of edge going into practice this week, leading up to Sunday's game against the Browns.
You know, years ago, I was working for a different company, and the company was sold, and we found out about it, and they fired the general manager, brought in somebody new. And the salespeople, I was in a management position at that point, the salespeople were there at 7 o'clock, still working after the announcement had been made. And I said, y'all may as well go home because you've been evaluated for the last couple of months when all of this was in the works. So you're not going to change anything now. You were being evaluated when you didn't know about it. And I guess I thought about that with the change over to Coach Rizzi, because that eye in the sky, as the cliche goes, never lies. Every practice is recorded. What you put out on there on tape is your resume, and other teams look for it. They look who's taking a playoff. They can tell who's taking a playoff, who's not. But that being said, there was a difference in the team on Sunday, and that's when I'm having a hard time, I guess, reconciling in my mind, Steve, where the players know this, yet something like a change like that or just lockers or little things can make a difference.
Yeah, it is. You know, these guys get paid a ton of money. People will say that they should be motivated every game. For whatever reason, that definitely dropped off this season, even though it started out on a huge high with those first two wins. And then I think maybe a large part to blame on it is obviously those amount of injuries that piled up kind of helped to deaden the hopes and, you know, souls of players on this team when you see so many key guys going down. But like you mentioned, you're fighting every single day, every single week, every single game to maintain your status in the NFL. And hopefully players recognize that. I know the coaching staff sure does that. You know, what have you done for me lately business? You hear the Cajun Cannon say that all the time. And going forward with this team now, are you going to be on the team next year or somewhere else? You mentioning the eye in the sky don't lie. That tape you're putting out now maybe can reconcile some of that bad footage you put out earlier this season. You can chalk it up to, you know, being under head coach Dennis Allen. And now, like you said, this revival under Rizzi hopefully can boost the team. And I'm not expecting them to win out. I think that's pretty ridiculous to think they can just put together wins the rest of the season. But I expect the team, obviously, to be competitive. Nobody's tanking for draft picks. I know a lot of fans are hoping the Saints just do that to keep their draft position in like the top 10, but I wouldn't expect anybody in the NFL to do that just because we mentioned the fact that you're fighting for your job every single week. And so is a guy like Coach Rizzi is trying to prove himself, not just to the Saints, to the rest of the NFL, that he can be a head coach.
Not to mention put yourself in a position to draft another Stanley Jean-Baptiste. I listened. See, I heard you call a cannon out on that on about three names in the NFL on Sunday. Let me take a break. We come back. Speaking of Sunday, if Younghoe Koo-Dun missed those three field goals, chances are we got it. Well, one was blocked, but we got a different storyline here. So we'll talk about what the Saints need to look at, what they need to clean up. We'll also talk about the Cleveland Browns. I guess Jameis Winston, the gift that keeps on giving. Coming back here, 504-260-1870. If you have any questions or comments for Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director, talking about the Saints and their resurrection, 821 traffic now, WWL. 826 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. Bobby Hebert on Sunday on the point after was talking about Marquez, how you say his name, Steve?
Marquez Valdes-Scantling.
Saying that everybody in the NFL, if you had three names, you were a stud. And Steve said, what about Stanley Jean-Baptiste? And Bobby said, well, you got me there. So, see, I listen to y'all, and I appreciate it. Y'all do a hell of a job. Let's talk about again, a lot of stuff to clean up. If Young Wei Koo doesn't miss two and have one field goal blocked, it's a different game. And that, you talk about every now and then, you got to get lucky and you got to get a break. That in and of itself was a break. Alvin Kamara, Saints all-time leading rusher. I'm so glad that drop pass didn't ruin his day, Saints' day. But all that did to me was prove that he's human. The man's a human being, right? We all are. Tell me about what they need to clean up this week for the Browns, and where you look to find where you look for the most improvement.
Yeah, I'm still looking at that run defense, Tommy. I feel like if maybe the Falcons just stayed more even committed to running the football, they might have come out victorious in this game. You saw them, Bijan Robinson rush for 116 yards, Tyler Allgeier 59, both averaging a little over 5 yards a carry. That's not going to be conducive. And surprised that they weren't, sticking with it even more, considering the Saints pass rush this game. I thought it was the most impressive maybe we've seen all season. They were able to get the Cousins, take him down 3 times, also got an interception off of him. He had a decent day passing, but nothing that was killing this team. The run game, though, is going to be an issue. When you look at the Cleveland Browns, they've obviously struggled this season, too. They've got Nick Chubb back, though. They got a guy in Jerome Ford that's dealt with some injuries, but two definitely capable backs you got to keep an eye out and be wary of. But, man, I got my wish, Tommy. I got to say, at the beginning of the year when I saw all the schedule come out, I wanted Jameis Winston to take over as the quarterback of the Browns, because I've been dying for this matchup. It does take a little luster of it, though, I think, with no Dennis Allen around.
Yeah, it is the gift that keeps on giving in terms of picks, let's face it. Let's talk about the McCoy. Is he coming back at center? Because I know they waived the guy they got from the Jets, Connor. What's his name?
Connor McGovern was waived, yeah. And I would expect maybe he ends up back on the practice squad for this team eventually, just because I thought he did a decent job in the absence in such a short notice. So we'll have to wait there. But obviously when the Saints waived him yesterday, I think everybody kind of popped their heads up and, things perked up even more, knowing that if you're doing this, it's pretty good indication that McCoy's ready to come back off of this injury. He sustained a groin issue, had surgery. He was doubtful going into the game last week, wasn't ready to go. But I think after a full week of practice this week, you could have your starting center back in. That would be so wonderful to have your starting offensive linebacker from, week 3 is when McCoy went down in the first series against the Eagles. And it just hasn't been the same continuity there. It hasn't been awful, but McCoy definitely helps boost that entire group so much more.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate your time and your efforts. Y'all do a great job. Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. We come back, we're going to talk to Nicholas Mosca, Associate Professor of Diagnostic Sciences at the LSU Health School of Dentistry. We're going to talk about fluoridation in water and RFK Jr. and all of that stuff right now. Time for WWL First News. 847, 13 to 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Nicholas Mosca, Dr. Mosca, I presume. Is it Mosca or Mosca?
Mosca.
Because, you know what, Judge, Ian McNulty and I have that conversation always. The popular pronunciation is Mosca, but it's actually Mosca. Dr. Nicholas Mosca, Associate Professor of Diagnostic Sciences at the LSU Health School of Dentistry, talking about fluoridation in water and RFK Jr. And doctor, I played a soundbite earlier. I don't know if you heard it or not, from 60 years ago from the movie Dr. Strangelove, which I love, talked about fluoridation in water being a communist plot. I can remember as a kid growing up hearing about fluoridation in water and being a communist plot and wondering what the hell is all that about? But then I married a dental hygienist and I realized what fluoridation was and what it did. So with all that as background and context, take me through fluoridation in water, what it is, what it does, and all of that stuff from the scientific standpoint, please, if you would.
Sure. And, since you mentioned the movie, it struck me that we also put iodine in salt, we put vitamin D in milk, and we put
folic acid and niacin in breads and cereals. So I don't know why they picked on water, but anyway. So fluoride is a natural.
Wait, do you know? Do you know? I don't know if at some point in your education, how fluoride was it? Just like, well, there was the Red Scare going on at the time, and coincidentally enough, they started putting fluoride in the water, so people just automatically jumped to a conclusion or something. Do you know historically?
Yeah, I think timing is part of this. So fluoride, the benefit of fluoride for the teeth to make teeth harder and resistant to tooth decay was studied in the 1930s. And in 1945 in Michigan, the very first city began to adjust the amount of fluoride in the water to an optimal level to protect the teeth. The reason that, it was like wartime, right? And then the aftermath of that, it wasn't until the 1960s that companies started to put fluoride in toothpaste. So for a long period of time, fluoride was our primary preventive strategy to protect children, particularly against tooth decay. But what it does is it's a gas. It's a very active gas naturally, and it likes to react with other molecules. So it's in our soil. It's in food products. For example, black tea has a lot of fluoride in it. It just compounds, and it loves to compound with calcium in the crowns of our teeth, and that's what imparts that hardness.
So are there any negative aspects to fluoride? I guess it's like anything, be it an artificial sweetener or whatever. If you take too much of it, anything can be dangerous.
Well, when it was first discovered in the 30s, it was because high amounts of fluoride that were consumed as the teeth are developing. So this is in children that had consumed higher amounts of fluoride in their water. And that was naturally present in the water. You know, New Orleans, for example, is hard water, right, compared to soft, which means that we have more calcium and magnesium in our water. So in Colorado, they studied the teeth of children that had a brown stain on it. It's called mottled enamel. And that was the sign that that fluoride could cause that. And that is the most common side effect of ingesting too much. The teeth, however, were resistant to tooth decay. The children didn't have any cavities. And that was what kind of led to further research on it and eventually the adjusting of fluoride in water. You know, the optimal level, I should probably let everybody know this, the optimal level is 0.7 milligrams in a liter of water, and a liter has a million milligrams. So we're talking a very, very low, very, very low amount in an optimally adjusted system. In comparison, toothpaste can have between 1 to 1.5 milligrams in a tube per gram in a tube of toothpaste. And most toothpaste tubes will have like over 150 grams. So the concentration is very, very, very high in the toothpaste compared to what is put in the water by the water operators that adjust their systems.
Has there been any credible evidence at all that fluoridation is harmful to people as it is found in water supplies?
There have been, the National Research Foundation has done 5 studies over the years. Other countries have done studies. And they have found that the low amount that is put in the adjusted systems is safe. What is happening is, I think, two things. One is some of the research that has been done is misinterpreted or maybe intentionally biased in some way in its interpretation. So it could be either, right? And it could be just because people don't understand the study. So, for example, some of the studies that have found some more onerous side effects are called observational cross-sectional, which means a point in time where they just collect something from a group of people. And so there have been some studies where they collected urine samples and they tried to make an association that some of the people may have like a little bit lower IQ. But let me give you another example from research. Lung cancer. People smoke and they have a higher risk of developing lung cancer. Well, people who smoke also tend to be in bars, and they may consume more alcohol than those that are at less risk. But we don't say that alcohol causes lung cancer. It's because those factors are present simultaneously. And maybe the tobacco kind of encourages the alcohol consumption or vice versa. So you have to be careful with cross-sectional studies. What you have to look for are causal studies. And they also need to be non-biased. So, for example, in health research, a causal study that's well-designed is blinded so that the investigators don't really know the people that, you know, the risk factors that people may have that could contribute to an outcome. And so you have to interpret the research well. And then the second thing is how these things kind of take off on social media, these tools, this technology is really kind of transformed our society. Somebody can have an opinion and others are circulating it as fact. And so I think you need to go to credible sources. For example, the American Academy of Pediatrics supports water fluoridation, American Dental Association, American Medical Association, and kind of ignore some of that noise that could just be, you know, onerous interpretation.
And I would think, as you know, the Sewage and Water Board here in New Orleans has a thing going on about checking your pipes to see if they're lead or not. Lead in the water would be more of a concern than fluoride, accurate?
I agree, yes.
Thank you.
I mean, look at what happened in Mississippi, yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate your time. Dr. Nicholas Mosca, Associate Professor of Diagnostic Sciences at the LSU Health of School of Dentistry. Leave the politics and science separate. Don't confuse the two. Just don't do stuff that's crazy. 855, 5 till 9, traffic now, WWL. It is an ugly, rainy Tuesday, and it's going to be an ugly, rainy Wednesday, but then it'll be a nice Thursday and Friday in the weekend, and we'll look forward to that. And look, it's November 12th. I know we had a lot going on, but Thanksgiving will be here before you know it. And as I said, if you're a turkey, I would start putting my affairs in order. Ramon Antonio Vargas joins us now, editor and reporter at The Guardian. As he always does, talk about the latest in the archdiocese and the sexual abuse case. Also, this news that the Archbishop sent in his letter of resignation, as he was required to do by canon law. Let's take it one step at a time. First of all, good morning, Ramon. How are you?
Good morning. I am well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. I'm dry, at least for now. Let's talk about, before we get to the Archbishop and his letter and so forth, what did they agree to release in terms of files and so forth, and how does that fit into the context of this whole legal suit and maneuvering and so forth?
Yeah, so obviously they're still miles and miles apart on the monetary terms for, you know, how much victims of the clergy abuse scandal are going to be paid with respect to the bankruptcy case that the local church filed here in 2020. But they have come to terms on kind of some non-monetary terms, which we have seen in other church bankruptcies, you know, several dozen across the country. There is a model for what they agreed to in New Mexico, where the Archdiocese of Santa Fe, if I'm not mistaken, agreed to release these kind of clergy personnel files that would outline, assuming that they're all complete, that would outline what the how the church handled the careers of abusive priests and deacons. And they released it to a university out there. I believe it's the University of New Mexico, if I'm not mistaken. And then there's been a similar agreement here. And keep in mind, there's many other terms to which they've agreed, but that struck everyone probably as the most notable one. A lot of the other terms, non-monetary terms, are, in my reading, things that the church has already kind of promised to be doing in the wake of the kind of that charter in 2002, when in an earlier kind of like boiling point of the worldwide clergy abuse scandal was hit in the wake of revelations of systemic abuse and cover up in Boston. And really just kind of reiterates, you know, we're going to continue to do this. We're going to continue to improve on doing it. And there's just kind of promises that to this point, they haven't entirely kept. in according to the reporting that I have done in collaboration with my friend and partner at WWL-TV, David Hammer.
So let me ask you this before we get any further into this. If the Archdiocese of New Orleans had wanted to, there was already a model in existence in New Mexico where they could have just gone along with that, accurate?
It was, you know, it's only a couple of years old, right? And then also keep in mind that when that archive was kind of created and agreed to as part of a bankruptcy settlement there, right? And the bankruptcy primarily filed to dispense of clergy abuse litigation. Yes, I mean, I guess like that commitment was sort of made in the same context. It's also not something that, you know, that one I think is probably more less kind of chartered territory than some of the other measurements, which are, again, like just kind of copy pasting a lot of stuff that's already in the, you know, reporting crimes when you come across them, not letting you know, a policy recommitting to a policy which, you know, is in place to not be alone with children, et cetera, right? I think that some of the other promises that kind of like pad out the length of that agreement should have been followed, and in fact have been exposed to have not been followed in many cases. I think that you know, the reason that one stands out is that you've really only seen it in New Mexico, and the idea is that it is a publicly accessible thing that survivors and journalists and just, you know, maybe congregants who are deciding how they want to, you know, to whom they've donated, et cetera. They can, you know, you can go in and kind of see how any particular, you know, clergy abuser was, how their career was managed by the church.
So,
that is less chartered territory than I think some of the other things in that agreement.
I'm sorry. So I'm reading your story here. It says the Archdiocese would have 30 days from any agreement to select a university to archive the previously secret clergy personnel files. A website would then offer access to the archive, and any clergymen who were omitted from the credibly accused list but had at least 3 abuse claims naming them in the bankruptcy would have their personnel file archived. I guess what I'm wondering, and that would, that, what you wrote there, that mirrors what they did in New Mexico, or not? Or
yes, there is an archive that is similar to that, if not identical to that, already in place in New Mexico. We reported on it. We spoke to the Archbishop, the Guardian, in a series last year. Spoke to the Archbishop there, Jason, our contributor Jason Berry did. Spoke to the Archbishop who kind of created that archive, and obviously won some accolades for, you know, the transparency. You know, he said that, you know, the church didn't collapse in on itself when we released kind of some of the more, you know, shameful episodes of our past for people to kind of comb over. Of course, if you'll remember this list in 2018 that named some of these clergy abusers here, right? What happened with that was immediately there became a fight over how complete it was, who was left out, et cetera. Mm-hmm. To be clear, in New Mexico, they have run into that, right? Where it's like there have been arguments over how complete the files have been, how they withheld some, et cetera. So, you know, just if past this prologue, that's something to kind of monitor moving forward. Obviously, we've discussed an episode, you know, we've discussed here on this program repeatedly, an episode in which an attorney was fined $400,000, Richard Trahant, for, after there was some reporting in the media about a chaplain at Brother Martin High School who had admitted to sexually inappropriate behavior with a teenage girl.
This is Paul Hart we're talking about, to be clear, right?
Paul Hart.
Yeah, and
yes,
I knew the guy. That's why I'm saying that. He's deceased,
yes,
correct?
Yes, the late Paul Hart. And so ostensibly, right, so that was so remember, that reporting, even though neither Richard Trahant nor his clients had anything to do with, like, the media, you know, provided the information to the media that reported it, they were removed, right? They were removed from So Trahant was fined $400,000. Some of his and his colleagues' clients were removed from participation in a committee that represents the interests of clergy abuse claimants in the bankruptcy, right? Ostensibly, all that stuff is going to eventually be made public. And I think obviously probably a sore point among them that, like, okay, so now you're going to release something that was kind of used as a cudgel to remove clergy abuse claimants from participating in the committee, advocating for their interests and to find their attorney. But for now, I mean, despite probably some of that soreness, that is something that both sides have agreed to do. They're going to accept that as a non-monetary kind of relief measure. The clergy abuse survivor side, and then that is a concession that the church has agreed to make.
Why get a university involved with an archive? What am I missing here, Ramon?
I think the idea is that it's just also like curated and handled probably by an outside thing. I believe, you know, in New Mexico, if I'm not mistaken, I'll be curious to see. I mean, it's a public university, I believe, that is curating kind of that archive. It is not a parochial university institution, Catholic institution. So there's probably some like level of like, okay, like this is something that we're kind of like turning over to be like our documents to be like turned over to outside of our control, outside of our purview, right? Obviously, they're providing the documents. They call whichever documents go in. In theory, at that point, that archive isn't going to be residing at like the administrative offices on Walmsley, right? So again, it's a matter of like making it more accessible and making it more to the extent that anybody. I mean, again, it remains to be seen which university is going to ultimately get it, right? If it's a Catholic university, you know, I guess that'd be something to note. If it's a public university, right? Maybe, you know, to the extent that is a public university maybe a more welcoming environment to someone who was a clergy abuse victim, or, you know, has a clergy abuse victim loved one, a survivor loved one. That seems to be my read of that. Right. I will confirm as we speak, I believe, the archive in New Mexico that kind of plowed the ground on this was at a public university as opposed to like a Catholic university.
I guess what I'm wondering, if the idea behind this is transparency, accurate, why would you even bring somebody else? Why would you bring another party into it? Why not release it directly to, for example, the media?
It will presumably be, right? I mean, presumably, like that's something that like the media can access. It's something that everyone can access, right?
The raw data.
And just to confirm, it was established at the University of New Mexico, which is like their state university, right? I'm sorry, you had just asked me.
Well, I was just saying the raw data. Why not just release that to the media if the idea is transparency? Why even? And I'm not trying to be a conspiracy theorist here, but why even put some another party in the chain?
I don't really have an answer directly to that. I do, presumably that is going to be a publicly. I mean the idea is that it's publicly accessible, you know, wherever those things physically reside, you know, everyone will be able to access that.
Will the plaintiff's attorneys have access to monitor these records to see what goes into the archive, what doesn't? Is somebody going to have access to this?
Well, I mean, yeah, I there is a set of people that know kind of what's been turned up, right? And we, you know, there's a lot of these documents are in the possession of law enforcement, right? So one of the things that... Not to tip our hands, such as it were, right? I mean, obviously, one of the first things you're going to be like looking at is, I mean, I personally have been able to, you know, obtain some of these clergy personnel files that were, you know, kind of shielded from public view once the bankruptcy was filed. I mean, one of the first things I'll be doing is comparing set A, which are the ones that are, you know, in already out there, versus like set B, which is whenever. And to see, like, is it a one-to-one comparison? Were some things left off? Like, obviously, and again, in New Mexico, right, there have been allegations of that, you know, there things that should be in there aren't in there. And so it very echoes very much so the argument about, like, well, this person should have been on the list and they weren't on the list back in 2018, and I do expect to be having some of those conversations once this is made public.
Tell me about the state police investigation that's ongoing, and I know that sometimes state police won't comment on an ongoing investigation.
Sure.
And if any of this information that's being released will not be released because it is part of that ongoing state police investigation.
No, I mean, that's a fair question, and that's, like, a good point. Obviously, we don't really have a lot of clarity as to whether, we don't have a lot of clarity as to, we've certainly seen things withheld because, they're part of a law enforcement investigation, et cetera. So, again, like, that could be something that factors into discussion about, there's not that many files, that are in there. I mean, there's obviously some people who are beyond prosecution, right? Because they're dead, because of whatever. Other people are not beyond prosecution. And presumably those are, I can say that state police investigation is ongoing. Obviously no one's been charged at the, certainly we're all waiting for a trial of, admitted serial abuser, and retired priest Lawrence Hecker on December the 3rd, where that's tentatively scheduled. Then remains to be seen whether it moves forward. Obviously, he's been charged. You've got a priest and a suspended priest and removed priest in Pat Watney who pleaded guilty in 2023.
Yep.
Excuse me?
I know him too. Go ahead.
Yes. And they have been charged as kind of law enforcement's been swirling kind of on the perimeter of the stuff. But obviously nobody above them has been charged in connection with any of the allegations of covering up and things like that are on the record in sworn police documents. But for now, that's kind of where the situation stands. I do have reason to think that it is not on the back burner, but these things move slowly.
Real quick before I let you go, Archbishop Amon turned 75 today, I think it is, and he sent a letter to the Pope, as was required by canon law, as I understand it, saying that he was retiring because that was a mandatory age, offered to stay on through the bankruptcy. I don't know, would him staying help things? Would him leaving help things? What do the plaintiff's attorneys say, and what do the defense attorneys say? Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, I think that you're going to get opinions across the spectrum on that. The thing that struck me the most was I think that probably at the beginning of 2023, end of 2022, obviously this is a date that people have had circled on their calendars for a while, right? And I think that it was, there was a thought that it was inevitable that they were going to let him stay on. We've seen archbishops stay on well past their mandated retirement age. We saw the Archbishop of Boston just recently step down at 80, right? That's five years beyond the retirement age. I think that what struck me the most in his letter when he kind of told his, and I'm talking about Archbishop Amon here, told his priests and deacons, like, hey, I'm filing kind of my retirement papers as mandated by church law. It's up to the Pope from here. I've asked to stay on. It's up to the Pope from here. That's all technically correct. I think at one point it would not have surprised me to kind of be like, look, I have assurances that I fully expect to stay on beyond this date. And, proceed because I'm going to be around. It was interesting to kind of see the admission of what happens next really isn't up to me, right? There's no indication that he's not going to be allowed to stay on through the end of the bankruptcy, right? There's a lot of, it's a difficult situation for someone who hasn't been inside, who hasn't been there to promote someone in that kind of environment or to bring someone even harder to see bringing someone from the outside to come in with such a expensive, contentious bankruptcy as we've documented here on this program. It's a difficult situation for a replacement to inherit. But then again, to kind of that concession struck me as but really it's up to the Pope from here. And it's been a privilege kind of no matter what happens was kind of the tone of the letter. That's what struck me because I don't think that if he had turned 75 in 2022, it would have had the same tone.
It seems to me from a management standpoint, it would make sense to have him here until this mess is cleaned up, and you don't want to bring in a new person under these circumstances. Thank you, Ramon. I appreciate your time and your work as always. We'll talk to you again soon. Ramon Antonio Vargas, editor and reporter at The Guardian. We come back, we'll talk to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, about dealing with the election. 75 million people voted for President Trump, plus round numbers. 71 million voted for the opposition. We all live in the country and we all need to get along moving forward. 928 back in a flash, WWL. 9:33, 27 till 10. We're very concerned about mental health. We always talk about it every other Tuesday. Dr. Judy Ho, our good friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Good morning, Dr. Judy. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Did you go surfing this morning or not?
No surfing today. No.
Okay,
I'm still adjusting to my trip back. I went on a Disney cruise.
Oh, did you?
With my son. Yeah, he just turned 3, so we celebrated his birthday on the cruise. And actually, coincidentally, or maybe not so coincidentally, I was on the ship when the election results were announced. So I was actually kind of away from some of the mayhem that I came to learn about when I came back, essentially. Everybody seems very up in arms, obviously, about the results and have really strong opinions.
Was that out of California or Florida? I'm just curious, the Disney cruise.
I went out of Florida. We were out of Port Canaveral, so we also went to Disney World. We had a really nice time.
Well, you should have stopped by and said, hey, when you're in the area, let's talk about the election. 75 million plus voted for Donald Trump, 71 million plus voted for Kamala Harris, a couple of 100,000 voted right here or there. We all live in this country together. I'm seeing notices and people about talking about meltdowns here, meltdowns there, obviously not on the winning side, but on the losing side. What would you say as a clinical and forensic neuropsychologist to people about just, look, this is all one country and we all need to get along from this point? What would you say?
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously people have very extreme feelings about this. I mean, there are people who are saying, well, that's it, I'm leaving this country. I mean, but how feasible is that for the majority of people? And we have to kind of come back down to earth now that we've had our emotional showdown, if you will, because, you know, we're all allowed to have it. You can be upset about it. You can have really strong feelings. But at the end of the day, you also have to know how to move on. And I think we have to just start picking up the pieces and thinking about the things that we can control and the things that we can't. So one of the things that I think is helpful to remember is that we do have checks and balances in this country. So if you are somebody who was not happy with the election results, know that there is other people involved and that the Constitution built it that way so that it's not going to be one person making all the decisions if you really do not like our incoming president. But also, I think that it's important to step away from the political discussions for a while. You know, this is not ignoring whatever problem you think still might need to be solved, but so much of this is out of our control. You've done your part. You've voted. You've talked to people about it. You've made your expressions and your opinions known. And now it's really about knowing, you know, being wise enough to know the things that you can actually control to make your life better and to protect your mental health, and the things that you just have to let go because you do not have control over certain things.
I think the people that voted for Donald Trump have to realize that it's not a dictatorship. It is a democracy, that there are a lot of people that did not vote for Donald Trump. I think the people that did not vote for Donald Trump need to realize that we do have a constitution and it is a democracy, and that you follow the rules of the election, and that Donald Trump won the election and he won the popular not only did he win the Electoral College, he won the popular vote. So that says something about the way that the country has decided that it wants to go. So I think both sides have to be respectful of the other, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously, your advice is very, very wise. I think that there are some people who are probably thinking, well, that's easier said than done. They're still so upset about it. But like you said, you know, the people have spoken. We have a democracy, you know, and there have been many, many other close calls in our nation's history. And so people are going to have strong feelings when it's polarizing candidates, when there's close calls. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons. There's always a winner and there's always a loser. the way that it's built, you know. And I do think that, you know, to your point, it's important now to think about practically what are the things that we can do to protect our inner peace. You know, if you really think you can move out of the country and that's going to be your answer, great. I can't move out of the country, even if that was my decision or my thought. I think that, you know, for a lot of people who have voted one way or another, they might say, well, you know, I'm going to leave the country. And it's like, even if that was my position, I don't think that that's practical to move my entire family out of the country. So, like, instead of, like, continuing to fantasize about that, if this is how you feel, maybe it's better to think a little bit about, you know, well, what are the day-to-day things that will make me feel better about what's going on? And you have to remember, we have a lot of power in our local government. And I talk to a lot of people, you know, again, on both sides, you know, as I mentioned to you, Tommy, my husband and I actually are not necessarily on the same side in this particular election. And so, but there's a lot that you can do to be involved in your local government, in your city government, in your state's government. That's why we have states. That's why we have state policies. So if this is something that's lighting a fire under you, then get involved. We all have a way to get involved. One easy way is just to start attending your city council meetings. They're all open meetings, right? Mm-hmm. Or you can write your senator, write your congressman. There's a reason why those things exist. Do you remember doing that, Tommy? I remember in school, we were encouraged to write our congressmen and congresswomen, you know, about whatever issue we wanted to write about. And I think that was like as young as the third grade. So we have a template for it, but we're not activating that as much. And maybe if you feel like you want to do something more active about it, that's another way to go to feel like there's things that are a little bit more under your control.
All right, let me take a break. I'm getting a text from people talking about dealing with it with their kids and also dealing about mixed households where they canceled each other's vote out and living on from here. We'll talk about all that when we come back. Dr. Judy Ho, our guest, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. I'm no clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, but I think if you're upset, you need to just take a breath. If you're happy, you need to take a breath and not rub it in anybody's face. I just think you got to be polite to everybody. 940, 20 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:46, 14 till 9, back with Dr. Judy Ho in a second. Tommy Tucker, WWL, our news director, Dave Cohen, joins us with some breaking news. Dave?
A federal judge, Tommy, in Baton Rouge has issued a temporary injunction banning Louisiana from requiring public schools to post the Ten Commandments in classrooms. The state plans to immediately appeal, but for now, the Ten Commandments cannot go up. The judge says that it is unconstitutional. We have more on our website at WWL.com, and we'll have a report at the top of the hour in the news.
All right, thank you, Dave. Back to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. I'm getting texts from people here saying their kids have expressed suicidal ideologies, etc. How would you again, I said everybody needs to take a breath here. Just everybody, just relax. I know, you know, it's like you get all wound up and then after it's over and then you look back 4 years later, it's like, well, that was kind of silly to get that wound up. Tell me what would you tell kids or parents to tell their kids?
Yeah, you know, I really like what you said right before the break, which is like, you know, no matter what, like, just take a breath, you know? Everybody is just even if you were on whatever, quote unquote, the winning side, you know, stop rubbing it in people's faces. You know, there's divided households. There's a lot of people who have different opinions. And that's reflective of my household. Everybody voted a different way, including my extended family. So I think in terms of how to help your children, we have to take them seriously whenever they say that they're having suicidal ideation. You know, sometimes I think parents, it's hard for them to absorb that. So they'll say, no, that's not what you mean. There's no way you think that way. And that can feel dismissive. So you got to just open your ears and no matter what you feel personally, just say, okay, well, that's concerning. Can you please tell me more about what you mean by that? You know, you have to just ask them questions, even if it sounds like you're pestering, even if it sounds like you're annoying them, because that's how you're going to get to the bottom of it and then learn how you can actually help them. So take it seriously, ask the questions that you need, and then ask them, you know, what can I do to help you with that? So let them come up with some ideas first, and then you should suggest some ideas as the parent. Like, okay, well, do you want to go talk to somebody? Would you like me to go with you to a counselor and we can see if that will be helpful? do you want to talk to another trusted adult about this? If you don't really want to talk to me about it, is there another person, a teacher, extended family member, a coach that you'd feel more comfortable talking about this with, right? But make sure that they feel supported and make sure to continue to check in, because no matter what happened in this election, suicidal ideation is increasing among our young population. And so it is really important to address it at the root and to not dismiss them in the process, no matter what your feelings are.
What about respecting each other's opinions? Because I'm getting text here calling each other idiots and each other snowflakes when, in fact, both of the people that are texting here on either side are kind of snowflakes and engaging in name calling, and they'd be the first one to call the other one out for getting their feelings hurt. However, they'd get their feelings hurt just as quickly. A quick word on that, Dr. Judy.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's try our best to refrain from the name calling. I think it's just something that we do sometimes because we want to feel secure in our position. But I honestly don't think there's a specific right or wrong here. It's just your personal opinion. So let's try to keep it as civil as possible. Remember the importance of the relationship of the person that you're speaking to. And if it's important, then really value them and don't dismiss them and make fun of them for their opinions.
Somebody texted in and said, I'm a concerned voter. I've always been told that turnabout is fair play. Well, I guess you can look at it that way. I think you can always look at it as, okay, mutually assured self-destruction. I don't know if you're married to somebody that canceled out your vote, and you know, you're looking at it as it's going to be a long 4 years of living with this other person. I guess you can, as you said, if you want to move out of the country, you can decide to get divorced. However, maybe, you know, and we're going to go in here in a minute, but maybe we can leave it talking about this with, you know, getting along with your significant other, if this is enough to tear your relationship apart, maybe it's not as strong as you thought it was, or maybe you're greatly overvaluing the election and not paying attention to what is valuable with your relationship.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I agree. I think that, again, you know, if this is going to completely rip your relationship apart, then you need to look at what that foundation was in the first place. And if you do value your relationship with this person, then find a way to have a civil discussion. My husband and I have been on separate sides. We've been on the same side. You know, we have really seen it all. I've always found that it's so much more important just to start from a place of they have a reason. They have a rational reason for why they're supporting this candidate or this position. You know, I know my husband is an intellectual and intelligent person. I respect him in general as a person. I may not agree with his opinions, but if you respect your spouse, remember that most people have a very strong reason for why they're supporting a specific idea. And they believe in that idea. So try to be more curious about it. Like, hey, you know, tell me more about why you feel that way. And then in terms of how to get along, if you're on opposite sides the next 4 years, I think if you need to refrain from discussion sometimes, that's fine. Other times, if you are going to engage in discussion, you should probably set some ground rules ahead of time. Like, hey, no name calling, no trying to change each other's opinion, but let's just try to find out more information. I want to hear more from you why you feel this way, and then I'll tell you the same from my side. And then we kind of just move on, go to dinner, do an activity that helps bond us again. I think that it's important to set up those rituals and those rules in advance.
And maybe just on either side, stop for a second and think, maybe you aren't absolutely totally right. Just possibly.
Oh, my
maybe.
Gosh. Can you imagine?
Maybe.
Is it possible?
Maybe none of us are absolutely totally right. Thank you, Dr. Judy. Appreciate your time as always. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Quick break.
O'Reilly. Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Getting help for mental health shouldn't be as hard as it is. Mindful Therapy Group is here to make your mental health journey as painless as possible. Mindful partners with thousands of licensed clinicians to find the perfect fit for you. And also accepts insurance. Visit MindfulTherapyGroup.com.